Welcome to another Bible lesson presented by the Hamilton Church of Christ. In 1 Peter 2, verse 13, we read, "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake." This scripture is simply saying that we are to obey the laws of the land. The only exception to this would be laws that might be contrary to God's will, which are very, very rare. So the Christian is going to be among the best in the whole land so far as being obedient to the laws. He will cause the government the least amount of problems because he is a law-abiding person. That's the Lord's will for us. Won't you join us today in our Bible study?
I'm in the way, the bright and shining way. I'm in the glory land way. Telling the world that Jesus saves today. Yes, I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. Heaven is nearer and the way groweth clearer, for I'm in the glory land way. List to the call, the gospel call today. Get in the glory land way. Wanderers come home, oh, hasten to obey. For I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. Heaven is nearer and the way groweth clearer. For I'm in the glory land way. Onward I go, rejoicing in his love. I'm in the glory land way. Soon I shall see him in that home above. Oh, I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. I'm in the glory land way. Heaven is nearer and the way groweth clearer. For I'm in the glory land way.
Our study in the book of Genesis continues. We're still in the 35th chapter and at the 21st verse. Jacob had just now received the blessing again at Bethel. God's promises have been renewed to him. The name Israel has been reissued to him, and everything looks much better now. The ordeal at Shechem is over. Verse 21 says, "And Israel journeyed and spread his tent beyond the Tower of Edar." This area here beyond the Tower of Edar is thought to be very close to the city of Jerusalem itself. At that time, of course, it wasn't known as Jerusalem. It was Salem, and later to become Jebusalem. Verse 22 says, "And it came to pass, when Israel dwelt in that land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard it." But this is a very unfortunate and disgusting event. Jacob's oldest son, Reuben, who was now about 30 years old, and he no doubt was a young, virile man that, as at this point, has not married, and he evidently had very little opportunity to meet any girls his age. They were in rather strange country here. The event at Shechem had really made them leery of the people around about them. He really couldn't associate with the servants in his father's own house due to his own position. And so somehow or other, the association with Bilhah and Reuben led up to an intimate relationship so that they actually had sexual relations. Bilhah had been Rachel's maid. She was much older than Reuben, of course, and it was clearly a very abnormal situation. Regardless of what any of the laws might have said about this, this was not a normal situation for him to take his father's wife. As a matter of fact, we read in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 1, that it was not so much as named among the Gentiles that one should have his father's wife. Well, that's the situation here with Reuben and Bilhah. And as we said, it's a very disgusting situation. Bilhah was actually the mother of two of Reuben's younger brothers, Dan and Naphtali. There is no indication, and it's quite unlikely, that Reuben was guilty of rape of any kind. This was no doubt a mutual agreement between these two to do this. It may have been just some kind of a an infatuation that led into deeper and deeper involvement. We don't know the circumstances. It doesn't really matter. It happened, and it was not a good thing. And the one most interesting phrase here, and the most telling phrase here is, he says, and Israel heard it. Israel heard it. It just seems that it's almost impossible for something like this to happen, but what the married person does not hear it. Somewhere or other, the married person finds out or suspects it. Now, this is an event that happens many, many times. I mean, there are millions of people that are involved in this every day, but still, it is a very unfortunate thing, and it's always such a shock and such a tremendous blow to the innocent married partner. When this is heard, here is bad news. This is a situation that sooner or later will have to be faced one way or another, and the sooner it's faced, the sooner the innocent party can set up some standards and say, look, I will not tolerate this, the sooner there may be a solution. Well, at any rate, we don't read anything as to what Israel did about this, what kind of punishment he gave, except Reuben lost his birthright and his blessing, according to chapter 49, verse 4. Reuben was the firstborn. He should have been the one who would have gotten the birthright and the great blessing because of that. But the firstborn is not always the best. The firstborn is not always the most promising, and that was Reuben's sin, but it was also Jacob's affliction. And it was a very sore affliction. And we don't know what punishment, or if any, that Bilhah received from this, but it's quite possible that Bilhah was abandoned by Jacob because of this. There's always a price to be paid for illegal and ungodly sex. There's always a price, and it's not a good price. Among younger couples, usually the woman pays the heaviest price. In this case, the heaviest price might have even been paid by Reuben. We don't know. Not any more said about this. But enough is said that we know it was a very disgusting, a very unhappy situation, and nobody came out ahead because of it. Nobody was better off because of it. All persons were injured because of this action. And we should take that to heart today. We have the same temptations today, the same likeliness to sin today, this tragic, grievous sin of sexual impurity. There's always a price to be paid. It's a terrible price. There are always others involved. Quite likely, not only the innocent married companion, but also the future married companion of the unmarried person and the children. Untold numbers of children are injured mentally for life by these stupid acts of their parents. Next in this passage, he names the sons of Jacob. Beginning with the last of verse 22, he says, now the sons of Jacob were 12. The sons of Leah, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and Simeon and Levi, and Judah, and Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's handmaid, Dan and Naphtali. And the sons of Zilpah, Rachel's handmaid, Gad. These are the sons of Jacob, which were born him in Padan Aram. This is the first time 12 of the sons named. They are named several times through the Bible, even at the very end of the Bible in Revelation 21, verse 12. These names will be on the walls of the great city. These are the sons that were to be the children of Israel. They were to form the 12 tribes of Israel. They were to be the ones through which the seed would come, the promised seed, the Son of God would come through these sons. Jacob was now returning with his family to the home from which he had gone out long before. And these were the grandsons whom he would present to his father Isaac as evidence that God was fulfilling his promises to both of them. I'd like to say just a word here again about the fact that while at Bethel, God had told Jacob to be fruitful and multiply. Well, he already had 11 of these sons at that time, but he's talking about the fact that these sons would now be fruitful and multiply. This was the command given to Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth, the command given to Noah and his family to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Now we see it given to Jacob and his family. And this is God's intention for us. He intends for us to have children. He intends for us to raise those children and to bring them up in a manner that's appropriate. And we're told in the New Testament that where the Bible is speaking of women not taking a public part in the church, 1 Timothy 2, verse 15, notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety. So childbearing is a major portion of the woman's duty and responsibility. And it doesn't just mean that the woman only is involved in this. The man has a very great responsibility here also. In Ephesians 6, verse 4, and ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So there's a very heavy responsibility on parents to raise children and to raise them in a proper way. This means a lot of time and energy has to be put into this, and a major part of the woman's time and energy is in having these children. In our modern day, we are not fulfilling this. We have the Women's Lib movement that is now greatly in favor of abortions, so that hundreds of thousands of little babies are put to death in this country every year due to abortion. We have the sexual liberation, where sexual freedom is used and marriage is not even involved. And if the woman does decide to keep a child that's born under these circumstances, it'll be raised in a single-parent home. We're losing the family values. We now have a 0% growth rate in this country among babies. And that means our economy is going to decline. We're going to be selling fewer things, having less demand for products. There's going to be a smaller number of people supporting the older population, heavier taxes, on and on. It could be the decline of our civilization, the decline of our nation. This is true in Canada, United States, and Western Europe. I mean, this is a very common problem. And so we're not fulfilling God's command to be fruitful and multiply. We're not spending the time and the effort that is needed to have children, to raise them properly, and have families that are productive like this family of Jacob is going to be. And the Bible tells us about it over and over. We should get the lesson one way or another. Children are desirable. The things we should have under proper circumstances in a home that has a husband and a wife, and both are providing for the children and spending the time working on the rearing of these children. Our society is getting away from that, and we're drifting further and further away, not just a little bit away, further and further away from it. A major number of our homes now do not have a mother and a father in the home. The children are there without proper guidance, without proper instruction. A woman cannot teach a boy how to be a man. There's just no way. A man cannot teach a daughter how to be a woman. You need both. You need husband and wife raising the children. That's God's way. We've gotten away from it, and we have some real heavy problems that we're now involved in and will continue to be involved in until this situation gets better. I would like to read verses 27 through 29. And Jacob came unto Isaac his father, unto Mamre, unto the city of Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. And the days of Isaac were 180 years. And Isaac gave up the ghost, and died, and was gathered unto his people, being old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. Finally, Jacob came home. He had, no doubt, visited his father Isaac before, and Esau as well, while he was living at Shechem. But now his entire household had come home with him. This is the first time he brought his family home to live where Isaac was. Isaac was very old at this time. Not only blind, which he'd been for many years, but he was now, no doubt, very feeble, possibly even senile. And nothing is said about his welcoming Jacob and his grandsons, but in any case, Jacob was home again. Isaac was still living at Hebron, where Abraham had also lived. At the age of 180, Isaac died. And he lived to be the oldest of the patriarchs. Abraham was 175 when he died. Isaac had made his will about 40 years before he died. A according to chapter 27, verse 2. And we might note that doing things like making wills and setting the house in order does not make us die 1 hour sooner. But when we do die, we have assured that things are in better order than if we die without taking care of those necessary things. This time of Isaac's death must have actually been about 25 years after Jacob came back from Padan Aram, since Isaac had probably been about 135 years old or so when Jacob left home. Actually, Isaac must have still been living at the time Joseph was sold into Egypt, but the writer found it appropriate to mention his death at this point. Mention of the fact that he was gathered unto his people is evidence that although nothing much is said about it in this part of the Bible, the patriarchs did believe in life after death. Isaac's spirit, no doubt, was transported to Sheol, where the spirits of Abraham, Shem, Noah, and others who had died in faith were resting and awaiting the coming, redemption, and resurrection. Verse 29 says, "And his sons, Esau and Jacob, buried him." It's noteworthy that Esau and Jacob were still in fellowship with each other these many years after their first reunion, as the two once alienated brothers came together to participate with each other in the burial ceremonies of their father. Isaac was buried in the same sepulcher with Rebekah and with Abraham and Sarah in the cave in the field which Abraham had purchased in Mamre, Genesis 49, 29 through 31. We remember how the situation between Esau and Jacob was a very critical one. Esau had vowed that he would kill Jacob, and Jacob fled for his life. Now, after years, the animosity evidently has been settled, and it shows how that things can be worked out peaceably if we give it time and patience and prayer and work at it ourselves. So this brings chapter 35 to a close. We're now ready to begin chapter 36. Chapter 36 of Genesis closes that long section of the book which seems to have originally been written by Jacob. As was discussed in the earlier part of this study, in chapter 1, the divisions of Genesis are noted by the phrase, quote, "these are the generations of," end of quote. And there's good reason to think that this statement in each case marks the signature of the man who first wrote the material preceding the statement. This Hebrew word generations, toledoth, T-O-L-E-D-O-T-H, means historical records. And so beginning with the first verse following the reference to generations, then would be the beginning of the next persons whose writing is found in Genesis. And if this assumption is correct, then Jacob's writing began at Genesis 25:19, the latter part of that verse, and it goes through Genesis 37 to the first part of that verse. And the editorial insertions were made by Moses, who later brought these together. He brought all the patriarchal records together in the present book of Genesis. But in order to complete his own record, Jacob seems to have obtained from Esau the records of Esau's family and then incorporated them into his own record before finally attaching his signature to the completed work. At least it seems to be a plausible explanation of how these generations of Esau came to be included in a book which is primarily concerned with the history of Israel and the line of the promised seed. In any case, this particular chapter is occupied exclusively with Esau and his descendants. By the time Isaac died, when Jacob and Esau spent time together in connection with Isaac's burial, Esau and Jacob were each 120 years old. It's according to Genesis 25:26 and 35:28. Esau had been married for 80 years, according to Genesis 26:34, whereas Jacob had been married less than 40 years. Esau consequently had at least a full generation of descendants more than Jacob, and this fact is reflected in the extensive list of names given in this chapter. The most likely time for Jacob to have acquired a copy of Esau's record would have been on the occasion of Isaac's burial. It is on such occasion that children take more interest than usual in such matters as family records. It is also probable that Moses later augmented these original records with additional data that had come in his possession. By Moses' time, the descendants of Esau, by then known as the Edomites, were a nation of considerable concern to the Israelites. So we begin reading Genesis chapter 36 with verse 1. Now these are the generations of Esau, who is Edom. Esau took his wives of the daughters of Canaan. And then from that part of verse 2 through verse 5, he names sons and daughters. Verse 6 says, And Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters, and all the persons of his house and his cattle, and all his beasts and all his substance, which he had gotten in the land of Canaan, and went into the country from the face of his brother Jacob. For their riches were more than they might dwell together, and the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. Thus Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. Esau had 5 sons, and an unknown number of daughters, as well as many servants and much cattle. Now, of the 3 wives that he had, he only had 5 sons. After realizing that Jacob was destined to be the heir of Isaac, and he was going to possess the land of Canaan, Esau realized that there would not be room enough for both of them, so he began to move southward into the mountainous region southeast of the Dead Sea. Both he and Isaac and Jacob, when he returned, were still strangers for these lands, owning little home, but pasturing their flocks and herds, there was room for them. The region into which Esau, also known as Edom, migrated to previously had been settled by the descendants of Seir, and the central range of mountains had come to be known as Mount Seir. To some extent, the children of Esau had actually conquered the Horites and forcibly ruled over them, according to Deuteronomy 2 and 12 and 22. But even more, to a greater extent, they had assimilated them through intermarriage, so that the people eventually known as Edomites were a mixture of the Semitic peoples, that is, they came from Isaac and Esau, and the Canaanite people through Seir. So the inheritance was a mixed inheritance between the Semitic and Canaanite peoples. Verses 9 through 19 give the names of the sons and grandsons of Esau, and we'll not read these verses. And all of these sons and grandsons had risen to considerable prominence in the land of Edom. They were known as dukes or chieftains. And by the time of Isaac's death, they had risen to this prominent state. And this is the probable time when these records came into Jacob's hand. A total of 11 such grandsons are listed, 7 from Eliphaz, 4 from Reuel, and these are the sons of Adah and Bashemeth, respectively. On the same level with them are listed the 3 sons of Ahimabama, making 14 such dukes altogether. Esau's daughters, listed in verse 6, had no doubt also married Horite men, and we presume that his granddaughters did the same thing. We might also note that the name of Eliphaz's concubine, Timnah, is given, whereas that of his wife is not given. Probably this is because of the future prominence of her son Amalek, who became the ancestor of the notorious Amalekites, the inevitable and perpetual enemies of Israel in later years. The mention of the Amalekites at the time of Abram in Genesis 14:7 is probably an editorial addition by Moses to identify the region as it was known in his day. There is also a reference to the Amalekites as the first of the nations, Numbers 24:20, but this probably is a reference to the fact that they were the first nation to oppose the entrance of Israel into the Promised Land after their deliverance from Egypt, Exodus 17 and 8. The fact that Amalek was not of the same mother as the other sons of Eliphaz may have led to discrimination against him in the family, which in turn forced him to live in a separate region and to develop finally his own nation. The Amalekites in general lived west of the rest of the Edomites. We're going to close your lesson at that point. Next time we'll continue with the discussion of the sons and daughters of Esau. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying goodbye, friends.
No tears in heaven, no sorrows given. All will be glory in that land. There'll be no sadness, all will be gladness when we shall join that happy band. No tears in heaven fair, no tears, no tears up there. Sorrow and pain will all have flown. No tears in heaven fair, no tears. tears, no tears up there, no tears in heaven will be known. Glory is waiting, waiting up yonder, where we shall spend an endless day. There with our Savior we'll be forever, where no more sorrow can dismay. No tears in heaven there, no tears, no tears up there, sorrow and pain will all have flown. No tears in heaven there, no tears, no tears up there, no tears in heaven will be known.
Presented by the Hamilton Church of Christ. In 1 Peter 4, verse 12, Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. Here the Bible is teaching us that we're going to be tried. We're going to have times in which things are not going to seem to go as well as they should. And this is a testing for us to see how well our faith is, to see how well we hold up, to see how well we're going to remain faithful to the true Word of God. We all will have these trials, but yet in the future time, in the heavenly time, these trials will all be gone, and we will have withstood the thing that was to test us. Won't you join us today in our study of the Bible?
There's a lighthouse up on high, guiding lost ones to the sky. It will help to steer you safely
o'er life's sea.
We'll help to steer you safely o'er life's sea. Though the billows round me roll, I'm contented in my soul, my soul. If the light from the lighthouse
will shine on me,
the blessed light from heaven will shine on me.
I want the light.